This interview with Dr. Martin Hardcastle is part of the Jodcast. For the full show, go to www.jodcast.net.
With me today is Martin Hardcastle from the University of Hertfordshire. Just tell us a little bit about you and your research, please.
Okay, well, for the last 13 years or so, I've been working on radio galaxies. Jodrell Bank is a particularly suitable place to be talking about radio galaxies, since a lot of what were the early work on radio galaxies were done here. A lot of the early discoveries were made. The first ever map of a radio galaxy was made by University of Manchester students slightly more than 50 years ago.
Just so we know what we're talking about, what is a radio galaxy as opposed to a normal galaxy?
Well, that's a very good question. Most galaxies are sources of radio waves. If you look at the night sky in radio, if you had radio eyes, you would see that the Milky Way is a strong source of radio waves. The radio emission actually there comes from charged particles in the galaxy moving about in the magnetic field inside the galaxy. Now, the Milky Way is not a radio galaxy. It's a source of radio waves, but we don't call it a radio galaxy. We reserve that term for galaxies that are very much brighter in the radio than the Milky Way, maybe 100 to 1,000 times brighter. And the radio emission in those cases comes not from the interstellar medium of the galaxies themselves, not from the ordinary charged particles and magnetic fields you expect to find in a galaxy, but they're powered by jets from an active galactic nucleus in the centre of the galaxy.
An active galactic nucleus. Perhaps you could explain what that means. Something's going on in the active galactic nucleus. What is it?
Sure, that's right. So what is it that makes a galactic nucleus active? The best way to tell this story is to forget about the history and to say what we know now. We now know that in the centre of all massive galaxies there is a supermassive black hole. In the Milky Way, for example, we know very well there's a massive black hole with a mass of about 3 million times the mass of the Sun. In the most massive elliptical galaxies that we can see in the nearby universe, the masses of those black holes can go up to a few billion times the mass of the Sun. So essentially every massive galaxy has a black hole. Now, in most of those galaxies, nothing very much is happening. The black hole is sitting there, and occasionally it might swallow a star, or it might suck up a little bit of gas. People think of black holes as cosmic vacuum cleaners, but they're not. They just behave like any other source of gravity in the galaxy. So if something doesn't come very near them, then nothing happens. And it's very hard, in fact, to detect them. You detect them by seeing the motions of stars around them and the motions of gas around them. It's quite a difficult process to detect and measure these black holes. But in an active galaxy, there's a lot of stuff going on around the black hole. Material is falling in, and that material can power all sorts of phenomena in the centres of galaxies, including radio galaxies, but also including things that people have often heard of, like quasars, Seyfert galaxies, and so on.
So when you're talking about the radio galaxies, you're talking about they're typically active galactic nuclei galaxies. They have a supermassive black hole at their centre, drawing in lots of material, and all sorts of interesting physics is occurring and producing strong radio waves. How many of these galaxies do we know of?
We know of a large number, but then we know of a large number of galaxies. I mean, we know of thousands of radio galaxies, but we know of millions of galaxies. As a fraction of the total, radio galaxies are pretty rare. They're a small fraction of the total number of active galaxies, in fact. But there are reasons why they're particularly interesting. Most active galaxies, what you see is emission mostly from the central regions around the supermassive black hole. You see bright optical, you see X-ray emission. You sometimes see some radio emission. That's a sign that processes are going on immediately around the black hole. But radio galaxies are unique in that they can influence the environment around them, not just at the black hole, but on very much larger scales. They can have effects on scales that are much larger than the optical galaxy that we can see, in fact. The way they do that is jets of material leave the region close to the massive black hole, and I should say at this point that nobody really knows how these jets are generated. That the mechanism of getting jets out when you expect matter to be falling in is, there are many ideas, but there's no definite answer to that question, simply because in galaxies apart from our own, the black hole is too far away to study, so we don't have enough information to see how the jets are made.
These are jets of what?
Again, on very small scales, the answer is we don't know what the jets are made of. We know what they're made of by the time they get out to distances of, say, hundreds of light years from the core, from the very central regions. By that stage, we know that they have got charged particles and magnetic fields in them. The reason that we know that is that we see radio waves coming from them, and the signature of that sort of collection of very energetic charged particles and magnetic fields is a radiation we call synchrotron radiation, which shows up in the radio. The problem of what the jets are made of is tied up with the problem of how they get out of the central black hole, and we don't know the answer to either of those questions. Energy can change its form, so you know, energy jets can get out of the central region in one form and then change into this form of electrons and magnetic field that we see at larger distances.
What do we learn from observations of active galactic nuclei?
Well, we learn several things. The most common use of active galactic nuclei in general at the moment is as signposts for a massive galaxy, in effect. People are using them because you can see them for a long distance. The brightest active galactic nuclei, the quasars, their optical emission can outshine the whole galaxy easily, the whole galaxy that they're in. And so they can be used to look for structure at very large distances. There's some use of radio galaxies for that purpose as well, but that's not really what I think is the main interest in radio galaxies at the moment. You can obviously learn something about the process of material falling onto the black hole, about the evolution of black holes in the universe. That also, I think, is not really the main interest of radio galaxies. The main interest in radio galaxies is that because they affect not just the area immediately around them, but the galaxy and the medium that the galaxy lives in on very large scales, they actually provide a way of getting some of that energy out and influencing the galaxy, influencing the evolution of the galaxy and the evolution of the gas that surrounds the galaxy. So what I'm most interested in is exactly how the large-scale radio galaxy evolves and how it interacts with the galaxy that it lives in.
So you're essentially talking about a radio galaxy as being part of a larger galaxy. We see in radio lights a radio galaxy, but it is actually just the radio emission from a larger galaxy. So you're essentially talking about how the radio emission comes from part of the galaxy where matter is essentially being recycled out of the galaxy into this active region and then back out into the galaxy. That tells us what exactly?
I mean, that process of recycling, or as some people call it, feedback, tells us about the life cycle of matter in the galaxy in a way. The material that falls into the black hole, of course, doesn't really come out again. That's the definition of a black hole. But energy can be recycled, and energy is being recycled in these systems from the very smallest scales where the black hole is being fueled out to scales that are actually much larger than the optical galaxy itself. So what we're learning about is how energy is distributed between the different components of a galaxy and how what you might call the thermal history of a galaxy, the history of energy transport in and out of a galaxy. In a large galaxy, it turns out that you need, in order to keep the atmosphere of a galaxy hot, you need processes that transport energy out, just as you have processes that transport energy inwards into the centre. And the interplay between those processes actually explains how the galaxies that we see have evolved. So without understanding how those processes work and without understanding how you get feedback from the centre out to the edges, you can't get a full picture of the evolution of galaxies.
And interesting phrase there, the atmosphere of a galaxy. Do you view galaxies as being something similar to a planet, where it has got different components to a galaxy in the same way there are different components to, say, our own Earth, and there are interplayers between these various aspects of the object, be it a planet or be it a galaxy?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very easy to think of a galaxy as simply a collection of stars, but radio astronomers and X-ray astronomers look at a galaxy in a very different way. They see a galaxy as a collection of gas with occasional stars embedded in it. In fact, in a massive galaxy, the atmosphere or the halo of hot X-ray-emitting gas around a galaxy can be much more massive than the stars. By the time you're looking at a cluster or a group of galaxies, the hot gas atmosphere dwarfs the planet, so that would be like a gas giant. The tiny core of stars is all we can see in the optical. But the X-ray gas is much more important in terms of the dynamics and the overall mass of the system. So even in our own galaxy, there is lots that you can't see, lots of cold gas, of hot gas, of warm gas, as well. And all we see when we look at the night sky are the stars, effectively. In more massive galaxies, it's even more important to understand all the different constituents of the galaxy. And the stars turn out not to be very interesting. A radio galaxy doesn't have very much effect on stars, or vice versa. Stars behave like little solid bodies, but the interaction between the different phases of more tenuous gas, the radio-emitting material from the radio galaxy, the X-ray-emitting material from the hot atmosphere, the cold gas that floats around, which we don't see until we see it's forming stars. All of these phases interact with each other, and that's the interaction that we're trying to study.
Does the radio emission from a radio galaxy change over time? Does it get stronger? Does it get weaker? Does it stay the same? Do these things turn off? Do these things appear suddenly?
Yes, yes to all of those questions. A radio galaxy grows and changes over its lifetime. As these jets, if you imagine these jets suddenly turning on in the centre of a galaxy, what they do is they blow bubbles in the gas of the galaxy. The bubbles are filled with the radio-emitting material that we can observe. It pushes out of the way the other sorts of gas that are normally there in a galactic atmosphere. Those bubbles get bigger, partly because bubbles just do get bigger, and partly because they're still being fed by the jets, so more stuff is being pumped into them. So you can imagine if you get a large swimming pool and you put an air hose at the bottom of it and you see what happens. You'll see a rising bubble, and the bubble will be continuously fed by more air coming up from the air hose. That's the sort of process we're seeing. We can't see them get bigger because they're already too big, because they're already too far away, and we can't see things moving on those scales. The sort of radio galaxy that I would typically be studying would be a few hundred thousand light years across. So we're not going to see a very big change if we wait for 10 years and look again. But you can, in fact, see things moving up the jets if you look very close into the centre. And we can see other evidence that these things really are expanding. They're pushing material out of the way. They're compressing it and heating it and shocking it as they go through the gas. So we know that they are expanding. And so we expect to see an evolution with time. The problem is that the lifetime of these things is so long. They live. We know that the longest lived radio galaxies may live for 100 million years or longer. So it's not something that you can watch happening in the course of a typical research grant. You have to you have to get your information about evolution of radio galaxies by looking at lots of them, and that's part of what we're trying to do.
So obviously you would observe these radio galaxies in the radio spectrum. What observatories, what instrumentation do you use to observe these radio galaxies?
Well, any radio telescope will find you a radio galaxy. I mean, in fact, for many radio astronomers, radio galaxies are just a nuisance. They are some of the brightest radio sources in the sky, and they emit very boring radio emission in the sense they don't have any emission lines or anything that people might look for. So they're just sources of plain, boring radio emission. And you can observe them, therefore, in any frequency, from the lowest frequencies we can observe right up to the highest radio frequencies that we use as radio astronomers. And therefore, you can use any radio telescope. Our real workhorse instruments are things like the Very Large Array in New Mexico. Merlin, to some extent. Merlin isn't as well adapted to radio galaxies as some of the telescopes are. The Very Large Array, the Very Long Baseline Array. Mostly you want to have high resolution because you want to be able to make detailed pictures of these things. It turns out that the more resolution you have, the more you find out. The very early maps of radio galaxies would show a couple of blobs, which would be the bubbles, the lobes that the jets have blown in the medium. We're now at the stage where we can see exquisite detail of fluid dynamical processes in those blobs, provided that we have a nice high resolution radio telescope like the Very Large Array to play with. So we need sensitive high resolution telescopes, and this is actually this whole field is going to get a boost from the next generation of radio telescopes. There is lots we can't do at the moment with even with a Very Large Array. So the extended Merlin and VLA, the E-Merlin and EVLA when they come along, are going to be the next set of radio instruments to study these things with.
We look forward to seeing the results. Thank you very much, Martin Hardcastle, for coming and talking to us today.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.